मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Hi and welcome to episode 39 of Attention Please right here on Talking Stuff Network. We are recording this on the 5th of May 2019 and I am Vikram Mohan. We have an awesome episode for you today with a returning champion guest. But first, let me excuse myself in advance for all my sniffles and coughs that you might be subject to today. Ironically, I seem to have caught a cold in the 42 degree Hyderabadi heat. But our host is hopefully basking in much better weather. Hey Arnab, going by the recent news and with you being an NRI, I'm wondering if it's whether you're deemed qualified to talk about Indian politics, and should we be looking for a desi host who might still wear pink pants? That's all right.
So first of all, I do hold an Indian passport, just for the record. And even if I didn't, I will stop talking about Indian politics the day Indians stop posting updates on their Facebook saying Donald Trump is not my president. I will do it that day. With respect to Akshay Kumar, I think the problem before that was the larger context of it was that we had Bangladeshi movie stars campaigning in Bengal. And the problem wasn't that it was Bangladeshi movie stars. The problem was why were Bangladeshi movie stars campaigning in Bengal? That was the question. And so unless the concern is that there are Canadian citizens in India who are voting, I don't think that the Akshay Kumar thing holds. That would be the analogy. That is the real issue with Bangladeshi actors coming in. And if people think that there are Canadian citizens who are voting in Indian elections, then yes, Akshay Kumar is a problem. But moving on, today we have Harini here, returning champion. And really, really enjoyed the interactions last time she was here. We haven't had a guest on Attention Please podcast for a long time. And the only reason for that was the technology. I kind of lost faith in the technology behind having more than two people after that Raja Sen episode, which we could not broadcast. And I still regret it because it was a very, very good episode. So we have Harini here today. And one of the reasons why I wanted to get Harini was, you know, I talk about Indian politics, but I end up talking about only the things which I know and I'm interested in. And that's invariably Bengal politics and some amount of Delhi politics. But we never get into other states. So for Harini, I asked her, you know, what state politics is she passionate about? And she told me there are two states and I will let her speak on. So first of all, on those topics. So first of all, hello, Harini, and thank you for coming back.
Hi Arnab, great to be back.
All right, so
great to be back, Vikram. How are you? Sorry,
I am going good, and I'm following the Indian elections very closely. I think I know where this is going, but I felt I also knew exactly where Game of Thrones was heading, and I was wrong. So I'm prone to be wrong. So that's why I want to get a second opinion. So what do you think? First of all, before we get into the states, what do you think overall is going to be the picture once the election results are announced?
I think chaos.
Okay.
I think one way or the other, chaos, because I must qualify this. I have a 100% record of getting things wrong as far as Indian elections are concerned, pretty much like everybody else. The voters are unpredictable. The way most people sitting in studios or in cities who have no pulse of the audience or of the voters end up getting it wrong. But from whatever I have been reading from knowledgeable sources, it seems like some kind of a fractured majority for the BJP. They may not get as many seats as last time, but they'll probably cobble together a government. That's what I'm hearing. I'm also hearing that I'm not hearing too much about the numbers on the other sides, but it looks like enough to give a good fight.
So you now, think that, just to interrupt you, think that the BJP will come back with a majority? I mean, or will it be a minority government and they will have to shore up their numbers with allies?
Fractured majority. Allies. They will need allies. And that's simply because they did so well last time. it's very difficult to see them beat the number, let's say, for example, in a Maharashtra or a UP or a Gujarat, where they came close to 90% of the seats. You can't get more seats than that.
Right, yeah, absolutely. They've peaked. I mean, there's no going beyond that.
Yeah, and the fact that it's not a 1984 or 85 where there was the Congress and there was everybody and there were very very small other players where you could have a grand sweep. Okay, you have a much more fractured political system now. You have regional players, you have sub-regional players, you have regional satraps coming up. So it's what I'm seeing is much more consolidation at the regional level. And I see a certain kind of regional alliance coming in, which will probably dictate some of the terms to whichever government forms, whichever party forms the next government.
So do you think that the Mahagathbandhan has any chance of occupying Delhi? Or would we have Mulayam as, not Mulayam, I don't know, Mulayam or Akhilesh as Prime Minister or Mamata as Prime Minister?
I hope not. I was talking about UP and Bihar. I'm with Bihar. I don't know how the Mahagathbandhan versus Congress BJP will play out. Okay, I honestly don't. Votes will be eaten into by whom? I can't predict that. I don't know that those states well enough. But I was thinking much more in terms of, let's say, Maharashtra, or for example, Tamil Nadu, or for example, Andhra Pradesh and Telangana. Or even Karnataka and how the regional parties are forming, and maybe to a certain extent Mamata and Patnaik. I can see them demanding their pound of flesh.
Yeah, of course, they all of will. I'm pretty sure. And Vikram, you can tell me that, you know, the Telangana politicians will also, KCR and all of them will also extract their pound of flesh, but I doubt they have all India aspirations. I think I definitely know that Mamata Banerjee wants to be the Prime Minister. There's no two ways about that. So she would definitely want.
I don't know. I think New Zealand is a good place to immigrate to.
Or Canada.
Canada. I mean, I think that it's going to be like Venezuela version 2 if she comes in. I mean, she might be very good at whatever she does, which is the social welfare part of it. But I don't think she gets numbers. And I think that any person who runs the government needs to understand a certain amount of economics and understand the fact that, you can't deficit finance your way out of whatever situation you are in without having...
So there's a follow-up question here. So do you think, and we've discussed this before on the podcast, but I wanted to get another opinion on this, that given that the BJP will be on the lookout for allies, will they have to jettison Modi Shah? Because a lot of allies will come in. I don't think BJP is the problem as much as Modi and Shah is. So I think many of the regional satraps would be much more likely to embrace the BJP. Why? Even Mamata Banerjee could embrace the BJP for all I know. But yeah, the only rider is that those two guys will have to be out. Do you think that's even an option, or there's no BJP now without Modi and Shah?
That depends on who's calling the shots, whether it's Modi and Shah or whether it's RSS. RSS is a very goals-driven organization, and its goal would be to stay in power. And for them, I think that the party matters more, the organization matters more than individuals. On the other hand, if Modi and Shah are calling the shots, then I think that they may prefer to not have an alliance and maybe be in opposition and hope for a general election in the next couple of years.
So that's interesting, but I just don't think that Modi and Shah are going to be very good in opposition, because they have because once they get into the opposition, whoever is in power will unleash the full power of the law enforcement apparatus on them. And so I don't think that for them, I mean, I can totally understand the RSS perspective, but for them, I don't think that being in opposition is the end for them politically. So it's very vital for Modi and Shah to stay in power, or at least to hold, I mean, it's a huge loss of face. And I also think that it would be a terrible decision for the BJP person, because the BJP will be wiped out if they removed Modi. Nobody really cares for. But much of the votes that BJP is going to get this time, even if it's a reduced mandate, is going to be personally because of the personality of Narendra Modi.
I completely agree with you.
And people don't care about BJP. For good or for bad. He's basically hijacked the party. So if they then decide to basically turn around and no matter how they message it, but say, no, it's not going to be Modi, it's going to be Gadkari, then people will feel that they have been conned.
I agree with you. I think that it's Modi's goodwill that the BJP is playing off. The goodwill and the affection that a large chunk of the audience, the voters have for him is quite phenomenal. And you are right. They will feel betrayed if that happens. But I think that it depends on the negotiation. I think that it depends on what Modi and Shah offer the states. Okay, one thing could be more devolution. I think that all of them have been crying for that. So maybe some of the areas being devolved to the states.
So do you think Rahul Gandhi is going to... I mean, Rahul Gandhi was an absolute failure in 2014 in terms of he brought nothing to the table. But do you think that Rahul Gandhi, with his new image and with his assertiveness and I would say much better media presence than in 2014. To be honest with him, in 2014, nobody could have said anything after UPA2's government. There was it was good that he didn't come in front of the media, but now he's been in the opposition, so he can obviously take the high ground. But do you think Rahul Gandhi is a factor? Or putting it in other ways, do you think that the Congress, the party itself, is going to have a significantly better showing this time, which will gain credence to Rahul Gandhi ko PM banao?
I think that it's two things. I think just as the BJP is going to find it difficult to beat 280, I think it's difficult for the Congress to go lower than 44. But having said that, the Congress in the last 5 years under Rahul Gandhi has managed a fairly major change of perception. I think the change of perception has primarily come from Rahul Gandhi because he's looked far more professional and far more with it in this 5 years than he did in the last 5 years. He seems far more measured, okay? And when he talks policy, he's talking policy. When he talks other things, he's talking other things. He's not mixing up things. He's not making as many goof-ups as he did last time around. He's connecting with people. I think just as Mr. Modi has been on a five-year-long campaign, so has Mr. Gandhi been. They've both been campaigning for the last 5 years. And there has been an extremely gradual change of perception. People are no longer laughing at him. The Papu tag is not sticking anymore. Whether that will rub off on the Congress party, I don't know. But I think that they will do a lot better than they did last time around. I think that in certain sections of society that I've been speaking with, Nyay sounds interesting. And they are curious about ye Nyay kya hai. Is it about justice? Is it about money? People are asking questions. And they also want to know whether it's meant for them. Okay. Because when your maid and your driver ask you this, they're most likely people going to be excluded from the safety net. So yeah, there is some amount of curiosity happening. Some of the stuff on demonetization and loss of jobs is sticking. I think loss of jobs is a huge factor in this elections. I don't know how people will vote based on that. But the very fact that people don't have jobs is a big thing. I know students, because I teach, I interact with students all the time. Good institutes, people aren't getting placed. So it is a problem. Both graduate employment and non-graduate employment is a huge problem. So
how can you link that to the government's policies? How would a normal person link it to the government policies? That is because of specific things that the Modi government did that we're no longer getting jobs.
I don't think they'll link it to specific policies. I think that they'll link it to the fact that they don't have a job. Okay, government promised jobs, I didn't get jobs. I don't think that they will particularly link it to demonetization or GST or XYZ or ABC. I don't think people behave that way. I think that they vote on whether they are feeling better or worse than they did before. If they feel better, then they will vote for the incumbent government. If they don't feel better, they will vote for somebody else. I mean, it's usually, it pretty much boils down to that. If they think that the government will satisfy their requirements, whatever their requirements may be.
Okay. So moving on to the individual states. So let's hear it for your home state, Maharashtra. Yes.
Maharashtra is interesting because Devendra Fadnavis has been an extremely low-key chief minister. You haven't seen too much of him. It's Maharashtra has been pretty much business as usual. There haven't been too many violent incidents in the state. Law and order has been pretty much good. I think the problem is, I think it comes across as being terribly boring. In a world where you look for a charismatic leader, and I think this is Maharashtra's problem for the last, Prithviraj Chauhan was not particularly interesting. He would not set your screen on fire. Okay. Vilasrao Deshmukh, on the other hand, had an extremely good common people touch, a very good populist touch. Maharashtra hasn't seen a mass leader for some time. And I think that's the problem with the election, that both sides seem extremely boring. Friends of mine who I've been speaking to, people who are hardcore Shiv Sena voters, are pretty angry with the kiss and make up. Okay, so I don't know how they will vote. The Marathas have been fairly angry in terms of the promises made on reservation and the promises that haven't come through yet. So that's a factor. Raj Thackeray going around everywhere and rubbishing the BJP government at the center in certain areas may make an impact. And lastly, I think one thing which I think people have forgotten is that Hemant Karkare is a Maharashtra boy. Okay, and I think that this entire thing that has happened in terms of his memory by and the entire character assassination that has happened hasn't gone down too well in many, many quarters. Whether that will impact votes, I don't know. But Maharashtra, I don't see, I think that last time they won almost all the seats in Maharashtra, the BJP. I don't see them, I think maybe 50% is what I see them getting.
So who will make, so if BJP drops, who will pick up those seats? Would it be Shiv Sena? Would it be Raj Thackeray? Or would it be Congress?
Raj Thackeray is not fighting the elections.
Oh, I didn't know that. He's not fighting, like his party, MLS, doesn't fight?
It's not fighting, no. And so last time around, they ate quite a bit into the Shiv Sena's vote. So I don't know where those votes will go this time. Okay, whether they will go to the Shiv Sena, whether they will go to the Congress. Because while we see the MNS in a particular way in the English language media, the MNS, like the NCP, is also a Maratha party. Okay, so whether people are going to vote on caste, whether they're going to vote on politics, whether they're going to vote on the fact that their leaders told them to not vote for any alliance with the Shiv Sena BJP. I think it's becoming more and more difficult to predict the Indian audience. I think that in many ways, that entire sense of block voting is working in pockets, but not working in other pockets. In other pockets, people are behaving as individuals and for individual reasons. So I'm finding this entire thing extremely difficult to predict. But I see a major fracture in the MNS vote, and I see a fair amount of Shiv Sena supporters sitting home and not turning up to vote.
So why wouldn't the Shiv Sena? Okay, that's an interesting person. That's an interesting question. Why would Shiv Sena, who I guess would be more be looking to Uddhav Thackeray and in the Thackeray family, I understand that the current chief minister, who's BJP, isn't charismatic, and so there is no emotional connect with him. And you know, we've talked about this in previous podcasts, that ultimately people vote on good stories. They vote emotionally. Yeah. They don't vote based on, oh, what policy does this guy put in place, or what does he stand for? You know, they vote from a vague sense of emotion, and much of it is personality driven. It's connected Absolutely. To a personality, which is why the Gandhi family exists today, because for the Congress, they are their biggest brand ambassadors. A lot of people Absolutely. Still vote, but they believe that they will vote for the Congress because they feel an emotional connect with the Gandhi family than if they say, put Shashi Tharoor on me, made him the chief and made him the prime ministerial candidate. People would like, okay, well, who's this guy? I don't even feel anything for him. So that I totally understand. But why this is interesting, because why do you think that the Shiv Sena hardcore will basically stay home and do a nota by not showing up?
I think because the last 5 years, Uddhav Thackeray has been literally been the main opposition in Maharashtra to the BJP government. I think they've been rubbishing every aspect of the Shiv Sena BJP government. I mean, which is the most ridiculous thing, because the Shiv Sena was part of the government.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Uddhav Thackeray has been against his own party.
Uddhav Thackeray's utterances, whether it was in the Samna or whether it's in public speeches, was mocking towards Narendra Modi. personally as well as the BJP in general. So it was a two-pronged attack. It was not that they did not fire at Mr. Modi. So they were attacking both Mr. Modi and Shiv Sena through the last five, sorry, and the BJP through the last 5 years, Uddhav Thackeray and co. And suddenly they switched and went into alliance again. So a lot of the grassroots is majorly, I wouldn't, pissed off, confused, all of it.
Again, my perspective, again, this is totally an outsider's perspective, is that I've always thought of the Shiv Sena as a, rather than a Hindu right-wing organization, a primarily Marathi parochial organization. And it has just been that sometimes their politics has been aligned with the larger Hindu right-wing politics, and sometimes it hasn't. But their primary driver has been local Marathi identity. And as far as I remember, that there were times in which Bal Thackeray himself was critical of the BJP. And I've always felt that that was really one of their USPs. In terms of, that's how they asserted their independence in an essentially a Hindu right-wing voting bloc. And in contrast, for instance, and this was a great thing that he did in terms of creating an identity for Shiv Sena, which was disparate, which was different from BJP. Otherwise, what could happen was what happened to Forward Bloc and CPI and these other parties, yeah, which were part of the left front. I mean, they were originally, they had their own cadre, they had their own base. And Jyoti Basu, one of his political geniuses, was that he basically hammered away at his own allies. So his allies after some time became redundant. I mean, they were still there in the left front and they shouted from time to time, but nobody cared because he had taken their entire cadre and the entire rug from under their feet and had transferred them to CPM. So yeah, there was a Forward Bloc, yes, there was a CPI. But they couldn't distinguish themselves. Part of it was their fault. And I think Shiv Sena never fell into that trap.
I think that what you're saying is right until the last years of Balasaheb. Okay. He had a charisma and a personality and this image of being a contrarian that he could carry, carry off the essential contradictions in the behavior of the Shiv Sena. So, for example, unfortunately, when Uddhav took over, that personality part went away from the Shiv Sena. And I think Raj going away from the Shiv Sena also took away a large part of the charisma and the personality of the Shiv Sena.
Yeah, Raj Thackeray has personality. There's no two ways about it.
And he's a fantastic orator. I mean, hearing him speak in Marathi is like you can't shift your attention anywhere else because he's such a compelling orator. And I think that it's a humongous talent, a personality talent that the Shiv Sena lost when he moved away. And I think that if the two parties have to survive, I think that sooner or later they need to think of a merger. So let's come back to Uddhav. Uddhav is a nice guy, good intention, well intentioned, all of that. But he singularly lacks personality, charisma and drive. I mean, he's trying to make it up with media imaging, but it's not really working. He doesn't have that fire that his father had or his cousin has. Aditya is too young. Aditya is well-intentioned. He comes across as an earnest Boy Scout. But you can't look at a Boy Scout to handle the problems of a state as large as Maharashtra, okay? or find solutions to them. Maybe 20 years from now, 30 years from now, if he's still interested in politics and he doesn't think of it as a birthright, then maybe he can be in a place where he is chosen as leader. But right now, what you see is a Shiv Sena, which is singularly uninspired. I mean, Devendra Fadnavis is uninspiring, but Uddhav Thackeray is singularly uninspiring. And the Marathi Maharashtra Congress presence is even further uninspiring. So what you have is an extremely grey and boring contest between between these various people. And there's Sharad Pawar, who's like aging. And right. After him comes Ajit Pawar and Supriya Sule, neither of whom will set the river on fire. So Maharashtra this election is singularly colorless, and therefore, and it's a very hot summer. It's a seriously hot summer. So I don't know how many people are going to be inspired to get out of their house and vote for anyone.
Does this act as an advantage for Modi? Because if the thing is that nobody on any of the tickets, any of the parties is inspiring enough, doesn't that default to, hey, at least we know Narendra Modi? I mean, at least he's in our mind.
So I in Maharashtra, what I see is the BJP being able to hold on to most of the seats it held on to last time. Where I see a problem is in the Shiv Sena seats. Again, but I have a history of getting things wrong, so I might be getting this wrong. But I see Shiv Sena's vote crumbling. And Shiv Sena's vote, a certain section of their vote not voting for the BJP and maybe not voting for anybody else, or maybe just voting for the NCP, which is the next closest in their spectrum.
Okay, so NCP might, you're saying the NCP might pick up those votes?
I think so. And okay. When NCP picks up votes, you'll have the Congress picking up votes. So it's all, it's alliances everywhere.
Right.
Harini, just a quick question. So you mentioned, of course, that Raj Thackeray, we all know he's become a viral sensation, right? With even his speeches in Marathi are being circulated and people are watching it. Because like you said, it's entertaining. So while he's become a kind of anti-Modi or anti-BJP figure, is he endorsing any particular party right now?
He's not.
Or is it just anti-BJP stuff?
I think he's just doing the anti-BJP stuff. He's not endorsing any party. But he's telling people more or less clearly that do not vote for the BJP. I mean, he's not saying it in so many words, but he's saying it.
And with Congress being almost a non-starter, right, in Maharashtra?
Sorry?
Do you have Congress in Maharashtra? I mean, no, forget the NCP, but proper Congress is almost a non-starter in Maharashtra, or do they have significant presence?
At this point of time, they don't. I mean, they've got pretty much decimated in the last elections. But from what I've been hearing, they're building back. Let's see. See, the Congress is a multi-layered organization. It's National Congress and it's State Congress and it's Regional Congress. I don't even know if they speak to each other. So, yeah.
So do you think that by what is really Raj Thackeray's game? On one hand, you say he's not explicitly saying don't vote for BJP, but he's effectively implying that. Does that mean that he is, and he's also not contesting, does that mean that he's willing to ally with them? Or is there's no way that Raj Thackeray will ally with BJP, given I'm guessing that Shiv Sena is going to see a decline. So I know that they're not contesting, but just to get their numbers.
I think that maybe that at some point of time the cousins need to kiss and make up. If they're interested in politics as a long-term game. Okay. See, I think that let's take a step backwards. I think that the problem that you face in Maharashtra with the Shiv Sena and the and also the NCP to a certain level is the same problem that you face in Tamil Nadu with the AIA, DMK, and the DMK. What you have is essentially cadre-driven organizations that have become family-run concerns. And the family-run concerns don't seem to be particularly interested in governing. Okay,
they're not interested in governing. That's an interesting... Okay.
Okay, they want power, but they're not interested in governing. Okay, they have not put in place the structure. I think they're interested in power, but they're not interested in governing. If they were, they would put in place those systems and processes and structures which will enable them to govern better. And what you're seeing in both these states, and it's happened in Tamil Nadu earlier because of Jayalalitha's death and before and Karunanidhi's death, almost in a very, very span of time. What you see is this, that maybe you have a Stalin and you have a Aragiri and you have the rest of them fighting. But they're not somebody who can bring the masses out onto the streets the way a Karunanidhi or an MGR have. The cadre which enabled the best to reach the top, that entire system of talent hunting has been decimated. The Congress has found that. That's pretty much as what has happened to the Congress because of reliance on dynastic politics. The cadre-based system has not thrown up a meritocracy, and those desires of a meritocracy are migrated to other parties. But at the regional level, it's far more stark because in each of these cases, what you have is almost a monopolistic control over the power structure. And suddenly when parties implode because of the death of a charismatic leader, what you have is a vacuum. So I find that extremely fascinating because I see a period of chaos in regional politics for these states while regrouping takes place.
So you talked about Karunanidhi and Jayalalitha. So how do you, and I think there's another state we discussed, is there something you have to say? But what about Tamil Nadu? This politics, who's I really do not know anything about. So I would love to learn.
I don't know too much about Tamil Nadu politics. I see it as somebody from Bombay keeping an eye, and who reads the Hindu regularly, keeping an eye on Tamil Nadu politics. I don't understand the intricacies of it as the way I understand Maharashtra. But what I understand there is the very fact that you have two sets of people or two sets of main parties, again, which have the same problem. They are not interested. They don't stand for anything. And that's a major, especially with Mamata, you may like her, dislike her, you can have any kind of strong opinion about her, but she stands for something. Okay, she stands for a certain set of values, a certain set of policies, a certain set of principles. What you're seeing here is people who stand for nothing. What do you vote for, Arnab? I mean, you can't, how many pressure cooker giveaways can you vote for?
But isn't a lot of Tamil Nadu politics about personalities more than, and again, this might be my wrong understanding, but I've always, again, as an outsider, always looked at Tamil Nadu as being like this hyper personality driven.
Absolutely.
Place, and it's all about the personality.
Absolutely. Stalin has better personality. I mean, I find it difficult to remember the name of the Tamil Nadu chief minister. He's that boring. Okay. It's bizarre. They are terribly boring people. How do you get people to vote for somebody who is that terribly boring?
Saying that we can't not talk about Kamal and Rajni, right? I mean, Rajni, of course, is not in the picture this time around. He's still mulling over his options. But and Kamal himself, he's not known to be someone with a large fan following, at least in this day and age, right? But with the big two, that is the DMK and AIADMK, like you said, they're at their weakest right now. So is this perhaps the best chance for a new startup? Maybe whether it's a Kamal or in the future elections, a Rajni?
I don't know whether it's Kamal or Rajni. I think India is changing. I think that the old way of doing party politics is changing. I think people want meritocracies. I think that people want people who are linked to the land. Okay, and wherever you have people who are first generation linked to the land, look at Kanhaiya Kumar's welcome in Begusarai. Whether he wins or not is a different matter, but look at the connect that he has. I think you can't be, if you're going to be continuing down a parliamentary democracy system, we need to look at candidates who are far more rooted and far more charismatic and far more able to solve problems of locals. And I think that's not happening. Somehow all the parties are becoming extremely centralized. And the talent that's supposed to come up and take the party to the next level, I don't think that's happening. And I think that's a major problem in Tamil Nadu. It's also a major problem in Maharashtra. And I think it's an outcome of dynastic politics.
With respect to Kanhaiya Kumar, I have an opinion, which is that every elections, the intelligentsia wants to look for a personality of their own. So they can't, you know, obviously Modi is Hitler, so it can't be him. Rahul Gandhi, it's embarrassing for them, even them. I mean, they might secretly carry his picture, but it's embarrassing to publicly say that, you know what? And many of them are doing that right now. And I really applaud their honesty for finally bringing out, you know, for finally saying it, that yes. But I think that last elections, it was Kejriwal. Kejriwal was everybody's like dream prime minister.
Never.
But for a large section of people, and I think the problem with Kejriwal is that that's been the shocking decline of Kejriwal, is that he's even worse than Rahul Gandhi. At least Rahul Gandhi, he says what he means, and he's upfront about it. With Kejriwal, it's just been such a huge downward spiral for him. Now that he's being slapped by his own party people, and it's not something which is supportable, the violence. But it's true that a lot of people are inside AAP are absolutely disillusioned. It's been happening since 2014. And it is just because of his personality and because of his opportunism. And I think even the most devoted follower of Kejriwal, at least significant number of devoted, are finally realizing the fact that he has from day one been in it for himself. That everything... But I think this time they're latching on to... So they have kind of jettisoned Kejriwal. I think that's also... I kind of sit in the middle. I don't think Kejriwal is that bad. I think in terms of politicians, Kejriwal is okay. He's not the savior. He's never been. But, you know, where everybody is a crook, he's as good as bad as them. So now that this pendulum has swung to the other side, I will hold a candle for Kejriwal and say, okay, no, he's not that bad. But he was definitely fooling you the first time around. But with respect to Kanhaiya Kumar, what does this guy stand for? He stands for... He's a communist. He's a communist, right? And yet, is the intelligentsia saying that the future of India is communism at a point of time when this philosophy has been rejected soundly by history? Is that, or is it just the personality of Kanhaiya Kumar? See, in his, like, his, there is nothing called apolitical, that all of that stuff I've seen. Or is it just because of the viral videos and he talks well? Is it just because of that? It's the same personality. Is it that hooking onto the personality? We have absolutely no idea what he stands for, what his policies are, or what he intends to do.
I think personality, I think that it's also the fact that we are becoming, I think, world over, an audience and a voter community that doesn't read, and especially doesn't read history, except from a certain perspective, which is something that validates your own views. So communism, the number of people who think communism is a good idea is not funny. And these are people who are probably in the top income tax bracket. Now, I do believe in income redistribution. Okay, but I do not believe in a communist state. So, for example, I have for the last 3 years, I think, I've been researching heavily into the universal basic income kind of writings. And I'm kind of questioning how is it possible for any government in the world, either today or 50 years from now, as more and more robots take away jobs, how are they going to get away from having a universal basic income? So, for example, Anyai therefore appeals to me from a purely academic perspective, saying that, interesting, they're going to implement this kind of stuff if they come to power. How will it work? How will it impact the economy? How will it grow? And so on. So that part is interesting. And because now coming to Kejriwal, Kejriwal's problem was this, that he came in with something that was unimplementable. He came in with promising something which was direct democracy. And direct democracy anywhere is a bad idea, because if I ask, let's say I ask my building society that I live in, whether people should be banned from eating meat. Trust me, the majority will say yes. Okay, this entire thing that happened in Delhi with this lady who pointed to guys and asked them to rape girls for wearing short clothes. Okay, it's not a niche view. It's a fairly mainstream view. Itne chote kapde pehnoge to aisa hi hoga. Okay, so what you see here is that a certain kind of populism that's asserting itself to say that we also, our view also matters. So if I look at Kejriwal comes in with direct democracy, and he can't deliver direct democracy. Because if he delivers direct democracy, what you will have is mass guillotining and mass lynching and mass shooting on the streets, because people, mobs behave that way. The second thing that he came, and the second problem with him is this, that he became this guy in the playground who cries no matter if he's playing football, any other footballer comes near him, he shouts foul. Now, you can't be blaming other people on everything every day. Okay, every mistake of yours can't be somebody else's fault. And I think that's the problem with Arvind Kejriwal. The very fact that if I think of Kejriwal now, I don't see this guy who made promises, however high sounding they were. I see a guy making excuses for non-delivery. And that's a huge problem.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Again, it's last time we were discussing how much of a big impact Kejriwal would be in the Lok Sabha elections, and he didn't even arrive. And I don't think anybody takes him seriously precisely for that reason that you just mentioned, Harini, is that leave aside his policies, and ultimately, again, nobody really cares for policies when they vote. That's the unfortunate fact, is that his personality nowadays is about this endlessly cribbing guy who is always Modi ji karne nahi dete. And by doing that, he basically cedes the power to Modi. He basically says that I am essentially, you know, he calls the shots and he doesn't let me. Dude, you're the chief minister of a state. Okay. Now, I always say he's the mayor of a city. But whatever it is, his messaging should be that I am the chief minister of a state. And he's always, and it's not only that he's then gone and apologized for that too. When his caller was kind of, when the figuratively the courts came after him. He then apologized. He and his mates then apologized. So he first of all, he cribs. Then when he gets caught in a when he gets caught in a vice, legal vice, he then goes and he apologizes. So this kind of attitude, this kind is just not conducive to be somebody that you can get behind. And it's a perennially cribbing, backsliding, you know, submissive kind of person. This is not the person you expect in a leader. And he has not been able to hold his flock also. So that's one of the big problems, is that he didn't have a big flock starting off with. And he's not been able to hold his flock at all. I mean, his party is just him and two or three other people. That's it. And everybody else has left or are close to leaving.
It's classic dictatorial, narcissistic leadership. That I alone am right and I alone can deliver. It's like a what's called a Moses complex. You know, without me, the world will fall apart because I'm the one true, honest individual who will watch the watchers. I mean, or some crap like that.
But then that's, again, if he had stuck to that, so it's a question of creating his own storyboard. If he had stuck to that, in the way that, let's say, Raj Thackeray is, you know, in terms of a maverick, in terms of I'm not with anyone, you know, I'm criticizing everyone equally, then he might have a future. But he comes across this guy who first starts off by saying everybody is corrupt, sab mile hue hai ji. Now he's trying desperately to, now his main thing is jo mile hue hai wo mujhse milne nahi chahte. Now he's desperately trying to get an alliance with Congress, and the Congress is giving him the boot. So he doesn't even come across as this assertive, dictatorial guy who I think Indian voters, they love that. That's why they love Modi. They love people who can take control. And even if it's a facade of control, but at least they want somebody to look up almost king-like and say, okay, he is there for me. Kejriwal isn't even that guy. He isn't even that guy.
God, no. I mean, like, seriously, if you had a problem that needed to be solved, are you going to go to a guy who's going to cry to you first? Like,
yes, I can't do anything. Everybody's, the whole world is conspiring against me. Everybody's evil. And you know what's more evil? The evil guys don't even let talk to me. You know, they're rude even, with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And they don't let me play with their ball. I can't handle
it. I want to play with them. They don't let me play. They don't make me captain. They don't let me bowl. They only let me field.
Yeah, absolutely.
He can't be a leader after that. Which brings me to the person who's absolutely the antithesis of that. Mamata Banerjee.
No, but let me start with Kanhaiya Kumar. Kanhaiya Kumar, I think that's another question. I think, and this is something that goes back all the way to the 1910s, 1920s.
Okay.
The entire glamorization of the communist. Okay, there is an entire plethora of fiction where the guy who, or the woman who fights for equality. So there is communism, the philosophy, and there is communism, the practice. The communism philosophy, which is equality and fraternity and all of that, has always been the object of, I won't say desire, but it's the object of objectification. I think that people are made into role models because they are left-leaning, they have nice beards, they have that half-shaven look, they have that I'm with the people kind of imagery. And I think that's been for a very, very long time. And I think Kanhaiya Kumar is a part of that. He makes, see, the thing is not about the communist philosophy. If I have to ask you, and both of us are capitalists, I would think, am I right? All three of us. Hello?
Hello, yes. Absolutely.
All three of us are,
yep, yes, yes, I am.
Okay, so if, but you can't really, none of us is going to object to equality. Nobody is going to say that we don't want people to be paid a fair wage for the work that they do. Nobody is going to say that a safety black net is not is a bad idea. Okay, the problem is not with the philosophy. The problem is the way it's implemented. It's almost like a fascist left wing government that is imposing a certain view on its people. So the problem is not a kibbutz, which is a communist run enterprise. A problem is not a Amul that's based on communist philosophy and generates profits which it shares with its stakeholders, which is everybody. The problem is with a certain kind of governmental system that a communist party has in mind, which is, I remember watching this documentary series called The Power of Nightmares. It's essentially about the rise of the neoliberal movement in the US as well as the Islamist movement in the Middle East. And one of the people I think was interviewed was I think either the defense minister or the home minister of Algeria or Tunisia. And he's talking about the Islamist movement and the Muslim Brotherhood, which in those days had a lot of sympathy from the West because they were anti-government. So he says, how do you allow a group to contest the elections when their sole objective is to destroy all elections and impose their government after they come to power?
Right. I mean, again, you're absolutely right. The fact is that I think the strategy is always is to take advantage of democratic institutions and then to break them.
And I think that is a story of both the extreme right and the extreme left.
Yes, of course. I mean, that's absolutely true. Now, to be honest, I don't think that the Communist Party of India, as it exists today, from a very pragmatic point of view, is from an all India perspective, has any kind of power to, you know, go to the books of Marx or to Marxist thinkers and implement their ideal of what a state should be. I don't think they can Pol Pot this country. I think in a realistic way, first of all, I don't think they'll realistic in any of the God knows million futures that you can see with the time stone, not one of them. I mean, in one of them, Thanos gets defeated, but not one of them does a communist party come to power in India.
If they came to power, they would be fairly capitalistic. I think that's primarily because Indians love a deal.
But even Bengal was okay. I mean, Bengal communism was slightly different, but I think that their time has sailed. Anybody with a Kaste Hathori Tara, I don't think is coming anywhere close to seat of power anywhere ever again. Philosophy has been debunked conclusively. But Kanhaiya Kumar.
See, I don't know. Wherever the right rises, okay, and this is a normal theory, wherever the right gains ground, the left also gains ground. The center gets squeezed out, pretty much. So if you look at, let's say, 100 years ago, if you look at, let's say, England, you had the Tories and you had the Labour. The Liberal Party got wiped out. And you have this kind of a scenario happening in multiple countries. Right now, I see the communists being able to put up charismatic leaders. Okay, and charismatic leaders who have, because they got decimated, because their cadre got decimated in very many ways, or their cadre
got decimated, and they just couldn't. One of the big problems that communism faces in Indian politics is that if you really follow the tenets of communism, it is against all forms of identity politics unless it is professional. So they look at labor, bourgeois. So they have their own defined identities, and nobody wakes up in the morning and thinks, I love the bourgeois, or I will be really pissed off if anybody does something to the bourgeois. Because that's not the way anybody in their right mind thinks. They think on religion, they think on language. Profession is not normally a ground for creating a sense of community. I mean, they tried all of the last 100 years, they tried to create the brotherhood of the working class. Guess what? It never worked.
But I think it's pretty much something I was debating the other day, which is this, that I think that there's a Reuters piece or a New York, one of those pieces on why Indian women don't form a voters bloc. Okay, and the answer is because, I mean, at least my answer is because we are diverse. That I'm a woman, but I'm a conservative, or I'm a liberal, I'm a farmer, I'm a Dalit, I have so many identities, and I have... And I vote on what is important to me. I don't need to vote as a group. Similarly, just because I am a worker doesn't mean I can't be orthodox or conservative or whatever else. And this entire expectation of people to be homogenous in thought process, I think is what's going to shake up the entire system. I think that people have stopped being that. I think that vote bank politics, I don't think is that important. I think that this entire assumption that Muslims will vote for party A or B, I think Muslims vote for the same reasons as Hindus vote or Christians vote or anybody else votes. They vote for economy, they vote for jobs, they vote. In certain pockets of UP and Bihar, that may be true, but I don't think that's the way it works across the board. And as cities spread and as diversity spreads, as internal immigration spreads, what we will find is this entire hypothesis of people voting a particular way because they belong to cohort ABC I think that's changing. That's what I see changing. People are voting for what interests them. I don't think they're voting for party or ideology or whatever else.
I would kind of agree, but I would disagree with you on the fact that it's changing. I still feel that there are just some forms of, and I had written a blog post on this, I discussed this in a previous, this whole notion of thumos, which is a feeling of brotherhood with somebody else. And it's such a fundamental driver in everything that we do. I just don't think that is ever going to go away, because it's one of the three principal drivers of the way we do everything. And sometimes even our own self-interest, we sometimes don't think on terms of self-interest if the word, if the message is properly phrased. As an example, many people say that in America, so many poor people vote Republican, even though technically they are working against their self-interest. The guy will come and cut off their social security checks. But yet they vote because the guy is white and the guy is, you know, saying that Mexicans are the cause of our trouble, because he's appealing to another part of their brain that thinks of himself or herself as part of an embattled group. It's always that it's an embattlement. So I feel that that has not changed in India. Now, I totally understand the fact that maybe better than what it was before with urbanization, many people might be thinking on lines of, at least there are some people who are thinking in terms of policy. They're asking about, you know, even if it doesn't matter if they feel that they're going to actually act out on their promises, but even the fact that they're looking at the promises is encouraging enough. So in I think all of us know that politicians are not going to deliver what they're going to say, but at least that they said it is a small victory. So, but the problem still remains, I believe, that at least in the kind of elections that I have seen, and again, I would always predicate my saying my knowledge of Indian politics is through the prism of Bengal, which some people might say is fairly atypical, but it has always been about some form of community. In Bengal, it has been the Bengali parochialism. You know, the fact that so many Bengalis are saying that Modi is a good guy, he's not corrupt, he tells me that business is not as usual there, that there is something which is going on. I don't know if this will translate to seats or to votes, but I think that by far that this is going to be the BJP's best showing in Bengal ever. And maybe not this time, but if they can keep their game on, because they have Mukul Roy, and who's, again, not a charismatic leader at all. I mean, he's not a leader at all, but he's a very, very good backroom manipulator. And if they can get through with pure tactics, I'd be interested. I still think Mamata Banerjee holds the upper hand, but I'm not as confident as I was before.
Well, today's news started with Mamata Banerjee threatening BJP supporters who were chanting Jai Shri Ram that, you know, you have to stay in the state. So I think that she's showing signs of worry. I think that it's also not so much, it's pretty much what's happening in Tamil Nadu, Maharashtra, what's happening in Bengal. One party has been decimated. TMC has been pretty much the single party, it's pretty much been a single party state in that sense of the word. The CPM has not been around in those kind of numbers. People are looking for an alternative. I think that I had said to somebody about that the best places for the Congress party at that time in 2014 to revive are Tamil Nadu and maybe West Bengal, because there is a tremendous power vacuum in both the states in terms of parties and what they represent. Okay, so I think that the BJP is doing well to capture that space. People are looking for an alternative. If not TMC, who? Okay, whom do I vote for?
And I don't think that, to be honest, Harini, I don't think that people in Bengal are looking over Bengal. I mean, Calcutta is different.
Okay.
But people in Bengal are looking for an alternative. I don't think that is the case. I think on a state level, I think BJP has no chance. But I think at the central level, I think many Bengalis might be thinking that Didi is good in Bengal, but she's not perhaps that great in the state. In the center, and that Modi
maybe
might be a better option. Yes,
maybe,
so I think that is unique. That was what I was saying. That people now are transcending their kind of Bengali parochial identity. And somebody would say that, and you know, the supporters of Mamata Banerjee would say this is where the agenda of Modi has succeeded. That he's kind of finally making Bengalis think of themselves as Hindus rather than as Bengalis. But I don't think it's as simple as that. I think it's more an attraction towards Modi as a person rather than an assertion of their Hinduness. I don't think it's that deep. I think if you change Modi with Nitin Gadkari, they'll say, you know what, Didi is better.
No personality. I come back to that entire thing. The fact that you have charisma, see, leadership has to have charisma. The person has to inspire, no matter what. Good, bad, ugly. You need to be able to listen to that person, process what they're saying, and say yes or no. A lot of today's leadership, that personality part of it doesn't exist.
No, I absolutely agree. I think, again, you're absolutely right, because, you know, if you draw to an analogy to the US elections, I mean, Trump basically beat Hillary out on personality. There was no other reason.
It's a cranky old coot, but that's a personality in itself. You can't ignore it. With Hillary Clinton, there's like, I think there's a brilliant one which I read, which said that they reminded a lot of the male voters of their mother-in-law. Okay, and this may sound terribly sexist, but I remember reading that and I'm saying, from a very purely personality, how people react point of view, I think that's very true. I think that there is a certain sense of earnestness when you have, I've seen my father's mother-in-law tell him how to behave all the time. So people don't like that kind of stuff. They don't like being told what to do. So
I agree. I mean, personality is extremely important. I think we can all conclude from our today's podcast that ultimately not the better personality, but the more dominant personality will win.
Better is a value judgment. I think that more dominant personality that attracts you. And I think that one of the things this time around is that it's been very clear. It has been a battle of two personalities. There is Mr. Modi's personality, which is strong and dominant, and there's Rahul Gandhi's personality, which is nice and charming. And these are two very different kinds of personalities. And in terms of the interactions they have with crowds, with the press, with everybody else, that's what comes through in how you see them. But they both are, neither of them is a personality you can ignore. Their personality overwhelms, and you listen to them. You may agree with them, disagree with them is a second matter altogether, but you have two people with some charisma. Mr. Modi obviously is a far better speaker and orator. But Mr. Gandhi is not doing too badly himself. His media has been managed exceedingly well.
Yes, his media has been managed exceedingly well. I'll agree. Not just his media. I think his himself, his tendency to make gaffes or to, you know, step in it has definitely decreased. I think he's being minded. I would disagree on the fact that, at least this is my personal opinion, I think Rahul Gandhi is the only attractiveness that I see towards him is as a butt end of jokes. I don't think even his gentleness is so transparently a put on, because if he was actually gentle, he wouldn't then go back to his seat and wink. That was like the prep school boy saying, "Deha kaise ullu banaya," that kind of wink. So I don't think that he can hold the act particularly well. I'm not making a value judgment on who he is personally.
Sure.
I'm just making a value judgment on the way he's perceived. So the way he's perceived, given his background of being of extreme privilege,
yes,
he doesn't come across as somebody who is, he comes across, as, to me at least, he comes across as extremely fake. And where I think he stepped up is that, okay, he doesn't make the kind of meme-worthy, he doesn't give the meme-worthy quotes that he used to. And I think he's been speech coached, essentially, which is very good. But I just don't think he can hold a candle. He can hold a candle to Modi. I'm not saying he's better or worse, mind you, but he just cannot hold a candle on a one-on-one with Modi. I think there are other people who can. I think Kanhaiya Kumar can.
He's got a very good personality. And I think it comes from being able to speak your mother tongue with effectiveness.
That is true. And his personality is, he kind of comes across as somebody who is not being coached. He has a good sense of very sharp humor. You know, he knows how to get under your skin. He has that ability. And I think it comes from that. He comes from the Lalu Yadav school of oratory. Before Lalu Yadav became a, you know, a cartoon, and then basically an icon for corruption, he was a very good speaker. He had that Kanhaiya. He had that Kanhaiya Kumar touch of that simplicity. The the hair coming out of his ear and nose, and that light self-deprecating humor. But also, he had that whole thing. And Kanhaiya Kumar has it. Plus, he has his PhD. Plus, he has he's a little bit more polished. So he is well attuned for this generation's politics.
And plus, he had Smriti Irani as the publicity manager for the first rung of publicity. I mean, how do you?
Yes.
They
made him a hero. They made him a hero. He could have been yet another. I'm sure every year JNU has some leader of the student union who is a good orator and who makes provocative speeches. But they definitely, his luck was he was at the right place at the right time.
I think that but coming back to Rahul Gandhi, I find him his explanations quite interesting. I've been hearing all the campaign speeches across parties, but what strikes me is how much better he is at articulating a certain vision this time around than he was last time around. And I think that's interesting. And also I think that he is genuinely interested in the top job, which the last time around, he struck you as this reluctant prince who's been pushed into this thing that he doesn't really want to do. This time around, there seems to be wholehearted acceptance and moving along. And I think that shows in the work, that the sheer commitment, professionalism, whatever you choose to call it, that comes across, because he's no longer a reluctant prince who's doing someone a favor by running for elections or campaigning or whatever else. He's doing it because he wants to do it. And I think that he's come to terms with his entire legacy and stuff like that. And I think that shows more than anything else.
Well, all right. So thanks a lot, Harini, for coming to this show. This was very interesting. Again, we covered topics which we normally do not cover at all in this show, which is Maharashtra and Tamil Nadu. And I would love to love to know more about other states. I just love to do this. So I have learned a lot myself.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening in. Harini, you're on Twitter at Kalamur, right?
That's right. C-A-L-A-M-U-R.
C-A-L-A-M-U-R. And if nothing else, you should be following Harini for the most delightful doggy photos. So that's something which I look forward to. And we don't see too much of that of late, Harini. So please.
I know, I've been very busy. I'll do that.
we want more doggos on our timeline. Parting words of wisdom from you, Arnab?
No, that's it's been great having you, and stay tuned.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.